Here in America, in the weeks and months after September 11th, Muslim citizens who had absolutely no connection to al-Qaeda found themselves the victims of backlash simply because of their faith, a faith which is often seen as foreign and guilty by association and fundamentally un-American. Well, a new book, a very fine new book, hopes to counter some of the fears of Islam or of Arabs by examining the many ways Arab influences have actually shaped American culture, from food to literature to words like algebra or orange. These stories and more fascinating anecdotes than you can imagine are gathered in a new book called Al America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots. The author is Jonathan Curiel, a staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Jonathan now joins me by phone. Jonathan, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Your book, it's really something. It runs the gamut from Arab influences on American architecture to the English language to music. So I'm wondering, once you got started on this, did you see influences that you didn't anticipate, or did you start out knowing that you were going to find that much information?
No, I started out knowing a little bit of this information because I had written about it before for the San Francisco Chronicle, but I didn't know, as one particular example, I didn't know about the Alamo in San Antonio being influenced by Islamic architecture. I didn't know about New Orleans being influenced by Islamic design patterns, and it was only when I went to these cities that it occurred to me that there was probably a reference here, and that was because of the Spanish culture, the Spanish influence. And having done research at Oxford University, I knew perfectly well that when you think of Spanish influence, you often think of it's actually Islamic influence or a combination thereof. Mm-hmm. And so these two examples, New Orleans and San Antonio, were good examples of what I found along the way.
How difficult was it to get information like you found? I mean, it is indeed pretty much an untold history, as you've illustrated, and most of it was relegated to, I think these are your words also, obscure academic tomes and dusty library books. So you had your work cut out for you. How did you even know where to look?
Yeah, I did have my work cut out for me. A lot of the book is based on hunches. Huh. And again, I had done research in England. I had a feeling, a fairly good feeling, that there were these influences. But again, going to these places made me realize, I think there is an influence here. But it was only when I went to these, dusty history books that I realized, wait a minute, here is a specific reference to Arabic, the Arabic language. Here's a specific reference to Islamic architecture. I put two and two together, as it were. And then I create a bigger picture. And these weren't isolated cases, by the way, either. And this is one of the astounding things of my book, I think. You have the Alamo in San Antonio. You have New Orleans, the so-called French Quarter, which is really should be thought of as the Spanish Quarter. And beyond that, a kind of Spanish, French, Muslim, Cajun Quarter, really. Mm-hmm. But you have all these other examples. And perhaps the most surprising, or maybe one of the most surprising, was going to Christopher Columbus himself. And I wanted to start at the start of this country's founding with Christopher Columbus. I had a feeling there were influences there because of his time in Spain. Mm-hmm. And there were influences there, and I was surprised at how deep they were. For example, with Christopher Columbus, it's not only language. And with Columbus, it's with the title, his very coveted title he had. That title is Almirante del Mar Oceano, which means Admiral of the Ocean Sea. Now, Almirante is from an Arabic word, Al-Amir, which means the commander. And this title was given to Columbus by Queen Isabella herself. So here was an example of how, despite the Reconquista, despite the fact that Spain purged Muslims from Spain, They actually embraced Arab and Muslim culture, and this is one of the contradictions that I wanted to write about in my book. And it wasn't just language with Christopher Columbus. It was navigational techniques that were perfected by Arabs and Muslims. And he specifically cites Muslims in his journals, credits them for aiding him on his journeys to the New World. This is something I had never, ever found in any history book. I found a particular quote in a English translation of a Spanish book, And as far as I know, a lot of the information in Al-America, in my book, has not really been known, is not known to the general public.
Jonathan, how in the world did you find out that an ice cream cone was actually invented by Syrian immigrants?
Well, this is actually something that had been written about before I researched my book. Several outlets had reported the ice cream cone as being connected to several Syrians, one of whom, Abe Dumar, came to this country before the 1904 World's Fair. Now, I interviewed Abe Dumar's descendants, and they told me a rather fantastical tale that hasn't been told before, and that is that the Dumar family came to this country before 1904, before the World's Fair in St. Louis. Abe Dumar was one of the people who were trying to sell goods there, and Abe Dumar was actually not selling ice cream cones. He was selling holy water from Jerusalem, from Israel and Palestine. Now, Abe Dumar also was familiar with the zalabia, this kind of waffle-like pastry that was also sold at the World's Fair. Now, next to Abe Dumar's concession was this ice cream stand. And in 1904 in America, ice cream was sold in cups and saucers. Now, that made for problems because if people walked away with those cups and saucers, there went a lot of the profit. Now, Abe Dumar recognized that wait a minute, what would happen if we rolled up this zalabia, these waffle-like pastries, into a conical shape, which is what they do in the Middle East. He was very familiar with this idea. He rolled up such a pastry into a conical shape after this ice cream stand next to him ran out of plates and saucers, and thus was born the ice cream cone. Now, Abe Dumar and, to some extent, Ernest Hamwi, another Syrian man who accompanied Abe Dumar to St. Louis, they are generally credited with inventing the ice cream cone and popularizing it in this country, Abe Dumar specifically. And I interviewed his descendants, and they told me one reason they came to this country in the late 1800s and early 1900s is because, you know, he was accused of a crime in Syria. Now, Abe Dumar is a Christian Arab man, and he was accused by another man in Syria of a crime. And if it wasn't for that accusation, the ice cream cone might not have been born as it was at the St. Louis World's Fair in 1904.
I mean, you must be really good at dinner parties.
Well, you know what? I think I've turned into a pretty good dinner guest. I'm taking invitations even as we speak. And a lot of this information does lend itself to these anecdotes. But I think they add up, and I say this in the book, I think they add up to a bigger picture of give and take between the America and the Arab and Muslim world in ways that a lot of us, including me before I wrote the book, don't know about.
Yeah. Jonathan, you talk about the fact that Islam and Sufi poetry in particular influenced a lot of early American writers, even writers like Emerson and Thoreau, but also that in that environment, Americans were standoffish about Muslims because most of what they knew about Islam was filtered through the lens of war, and reading that, I couldn't help but think about the perceptions of Islam today, which are disturbing, to say the least. What would you say to the American people, based on what you learned then, about perceptions of Islam now?
Yeah, this is a good question because this is an example of history repeating itself. In the 1800s, in the mid-1800s, as Ralph Waldo Emerson was studying Islam, studying Sufi poetry from Persia, America was having an antagonistic relationship toward the Muslim world, and that was mainly because of the Ottoman world, because of Ottoman Turkey. At that point, they had nominal control over the Holy Land, over Jerusalem. There was, of course, the spread of Islam through Europe, and so there was this idea of a clash of religions, of a clash of civilizations, as it were. But Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, studied Islam, studied it through this book called The Practical Philosophy of the Mohammedan People. This came out in the year 1839. And as I point out in my book, this was a book that tried to look at the Muslim world through a lens other than violence. And there were reviews at the time, not only in the United States, but in Europe, that said if we knew more about the Muslim world through books like this, through The Practical Philosophy of the Mohammedan People, there would be less a call for war with the Ottoman Muslim world. And at one point, a reviewer said, and in fact, we went to war on phony precepts, essentially, on the precept that Muslims were just totally violent and nothing else. Now, I think there is parallel to the present day. I think if more people, especially President Bush, had known more, knew more about the Muslim world, knew about it through other than violence, through other than the fundamentalism that exists there, and I think we're all against that fundamentalism. But I think if people knew more about that world, there would be more of an understanding of that world and dare I say, more empathy for that world. I've lived in Pakistan. I've traveled a lot in the Arab and Muslim world. I've done stories on terrorism. I know that these stories are legitimate, but it doesn't mean that we can't have stories that talk about the other side of the Arab and Muslim world. This book is all about the other side. It's about Islamic architecture. It's about food and language and literature. And I really, really hope that if people read the book, they'll also be better educated and see the Arab and Muslim world for more than just religion, more than just violence, more than just fundamentalism, and more than just the headlines that we get every 5 minutes.
In 2011, Jonathan Curiel joined the staff of the Wikimedia Foundation as Development Communications Manager. His most recent book is Islam in America, published in 2015.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Once again, our best wishes to you and yours for a happy and healthy 2017. We face many unexpected challenges, but as we begin our 11th year of broadcasting, we'll continue doing what we've always done, focusing on hope and meaningful cooperation, encouraging understanding across religious and cultural divides, and raising up activists and advocates, leaders and community members who work across this nation every day for inclusion, mutual respect, and true religious freedom as outlined so eloquently in our precious Constitution. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We rely on your support to be able to continue this important work. As we draw near to our 11th anniversary of continuous broadcasting next month, if you've heard something that you've found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. You can also direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, all next year long, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Was the son of a preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me. Was the son of a preacher man, see what?